Welcome to Target Cancer Podcast. My name is Dr. Sanjay Juneja. I'm a triple board certified hematologist medical oncologist, also known as the Onc Doc on social media. And today I'm excited, if not somewhat embarrassed, really, because we have not had a dedicated podcast on radiation. Radiation is a very integral part of cancer care, and it has been for a long time. Sometimes I joke when people say, oh, so you like to cure cancer? I was like, well, if I could, you know, if most of my practice was always curing cancer, I would have been a radiation oncologist, right? Or a surgical oncologist, because that is directed killing. And we're going to talk about all of those things with, I think, no one better than Dr. David Penberthy. He is currently the program director of radiation oncology at the University of Virginia. And he started that recently after being the Penn State College of Medicine and medical director of radiation oncology at Penn State Health Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, which was obviously in Hershey, Pennsylvania. What I learned, which was super interesting only recently, is he was also a U.S. Navy flight surgeon stationed with VF-101 and a fixed-wing fighter in Oceana, Virginia. And in addition to this, he started a radiation kind of private practice that's been serving Richmond, Virginia for 25 years, now obviously doing a lot of academic things. And notably, he was the immediate past president of the Association of Community Cancer Centers, which I think most people know if you listen to this, is a leading educational and advocacy organization for the cancer care community with a humongous audience from doctors to NPs to patient advocates. All that to say, I hope everyone listening is equally excited and saying, yes, Sanjay, what took so long to have a radiation expert? And I'll just say it's to find the perfect one. And here he is. So, David, so good to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sanjay. Really appreciate the opportunity. There's so much to talk about. I can't wait to get to it.
There is. And it's, you know, it's something that I think medical oncologists, you know, if you have the privy of being at a tumor board or an academic center where you're discussing really the kind of more integral parts of radiation, you can start to appreciate how complex and also how innovative it is. But radiation, as we know, along with cancer care in general, can really vary based on where you live. And that's where, you know, advocacy and inequity is a growing interest of mine. And I think everybody's that listens to this podcast. So with that said, I hope this is not an annoying question for you, but can you give your, I guess, refined answer on what radiation is and what it's doing?
Well, we're still learning about radiation, but as I talk about this all day, every day with my patients, and so radiation is literally just energy. It's part of the electromagnetic spectrum. Radiation right now is used to create images on film, and when we treat people with malignancies, we're using energy, it's a little bit higher energy along the electromagnetic spectrum, which creates some interesting changes in cellular activity, and it's one of the best and most effective targeted cell killing agents known to man. And so every now and then I have debates with my medical oncology friends about what's the most effective treatment out there, and radiation is certainly there. It may be the most targeted modality, and so again, we're just figuring out ways to use it. Radiation is super, super interesting though. If you think about it, we're using it today. And it has over approximately 130-year history, dating back to Marie Curie. And her story is really interesting as well. She's one of the few people that have two Nobel Prizes, and she won one in physics and one in chemistry. And she contributed immensely to just the benefit of humanity. And one of the interesting facts about her, she was one of the first people to develop mobile radiology services, and that was used in World War One. I believe there's about 1 million people that benefited from those mobile devices that she created. So again, we're now 100 and some years beyond all that, and we know a little bit more now than we did then, and we also have the advances of all the computerization, and so we're able to do things now in such a way that's very effectively treating cancers while protecting critical healthy tissues. And so that's the name of what we do all day, every day.
I love it. And I think I like what you said, and I'm glad it kind of validates my statement. If I just wanted to kill cancer, you know, all day, then I would be a radiation oncologist. And it kind of ties in this concept of what we consider like tissue agnostic therapies, where basically it means like, hey, it doesn't matter if it's squamous cell or adeno or primary started in the head and neck versus the breast. And there's only a couple of them out there where, you know, I guess almost incorrectly when we say, oh, this is tissue agnostic, for the most part, radiation is that category. And the reason that it's applicable in that way is because we also always talk about with cytotoxic chemotherapy about attacking the replication cycle, right? And there's all these kind of like, you know, self-destruct signaling mechanisms that exist in our cells to basically say, we don't want this thing to foster because it's essentially too screwed up. And if I understand it correctly, that's kind of what's happening with radiation. You're attacking things that replicate and also causing this almost intracellular damage to the point of not being able to survive or not wanting to survive or repopulate. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a great statement. One of the ways that I describe it is radiation, it goes after cells that are in a process of replication. So any cell can be adversely affected by the effects of radiation. Normal anatomy, normal cells are generally not in a state of active replication. So they're somewhat protected. It's when the DNA is kind of open and exposed is when it's more amenable to the adverse effects of radiation. But radiation, once it creates its effect in cells, it unleashes this cascade, almost like a symphony of activity within the immune system. And one of the coolest words in oncology, in my mind, is apoptosis. And that's programmed cell death. And so, you know, radiation induces this in such a way that the cancer cells are more adversely affected than the normal anatomy. And so that's where we have this, what we call therapeutic ratio, where radiation is super effective and minimally toxic to other tissues.
And that's where I think it's, you know, it's important to appreciate that concept when it comes to duration of radiation and the time that you, you know, undergo. And I think one of the things that's really disillusioned me or humbled me about social media is a lot of times, you know, the concern that a treatment that mom or dad or husband, wife, child is getting is not the right one because they may say somebody else got it for 5 to 6 weeks. Why am I, you know, only getting it for 4 days? And these things obviously vary in the setting where if it's, you know, to reduce the chance of it ever coming back, which would be an adjuvant radiation, how we usually think about radiation after a lumpectomy, versus one tumor that we don't want to wait that 6 to 8 weeks to hope that we get a response with systemic therapy. It's causing a ton of pain or it's in a bad area and you hope to just zap it for something that you know works kind of more immediately. That may not be the 6 week duration and usually will be a shorter duration. So it all depends on what your goal is. But also, the duration then relies on how frequently or infrequently a cancer replicates because you're relying on that replication process to cause the damage to make it, you know, dissolve or die, essentially. And I think that's why in this adjuvant, a curative setting, when you do it concurrently, meaning at the same time with chemo or adjuvant, you're doing it for a long time because you want to make sure, I'm sure based on a bunch of fancy calculations, that if there is a cell hanging around, and when we recommend it radiation, it's because the data shows it makes a difference. Like anything in traditional medicine, at least we can say that much for the most part, that you want to make sure that you caught, quote unquote, a cell maybe that's not as aggressive meaning replicate so fast, but still had a period of time where it basically harbored this insult to hopefully make that die away. And yes, in the process, hurt the good cells around that you know, you know, will repopulate over time. And that's where that injury is. In an ideal world, you would have zero, quote unquote, bleed from your zone of what you're trying to radiate and have nothing delivered anywhere else. But I say that with an asterisk because that perfect world would require you to be able to see one cell. And we know we can't see that even on the best imaging techniques today. So there's this intentional, quote unquote, you know, I don't want to call it a neutral zone, but maybe a yellow orange, whereas the red zone would be the where you know the tumor is. You know that usually a local recurrence is something in the area that wasn't definitively either taken out or radiated hard on the head. And so there's an intentional bleed to be able to reduce that. So these are all these factors that go into both a radiation physiologist as well as a radiation oncologist on quote unquote mapping to be able to get the field that you're trying to, you know, take care of.
Well, we use radiation in all sorts of ways, exactly as you described. So sometimes we use it after somebody's had surgery, when a surgeon has eradicated the bulk of disease, but again, you can't tell microscopic disease. And one factoid that I use for the medical residents and sometimes medical students is 1 centimeter square of tissue is approximately 10 to the 9th cells. So it's a huge number of cells. So for us to be able to see something on imaging, it has to be a few millimeters to, a centimeter in size or for us to see it on CTs or MRIs or PET scans or, you know, the best imaging available, but it doesn't detect microscopic disease. So even when surgeons remove everything that they can see and feel, there's the possibility that additional cells remain behind. And so the radiation can help clear up the region where the surgery was done. And we have evidence of that. There are lots of clinical trials showing adjuvant radiation after surgery, for instance, in breast cancer. It leads to fewer local recurrences and improved survival. So there's lots of data along those lines. In addition to the adjuvant setting, sometimes tumors are not surgically amenable to resection, you know, if they're in a critical area in the brain or in the spine or something like that. So we are oftentimes doing focused radiation, and we have a term for that, stereotactic radiation or stereotactic ablative radiotherapy or stereotactic body radiotherapy. They're similar terms. Oftentimes, stereotactic radiosurgery is specifically used in or describes what we do for brain lesions, and Gamma Knife is one of the premier technologies that we use for treatment in that. But that's where we're treating an intact tumor with radiation in a very focal way and trying to minimize the potential collateral damage to cells that are nearby. And a lot of times people hear about stereotactic radiation and think it's a new technology, and it's been refined over time, but it's a technology that was developed in the 50s and 60s. And so now we have 60 years experience and lots of data showing the benefits of that. And so again, we are every day learning about these technologies and learning about ways to use it in more effective ways that are less toxic. One of the interesting things, I think stereotactic radiosurgery with Lars Lexell, the Gamma Knife development, he kind of proved the concept in the brain. When he was first doing this in the 60s, he was considered a little bit out there as far as, you know, what he was doing. And in the 1960s, that was kind of an era of big surgery, if you will. And at the end of his career, when he had proved the effectiveness of Gamma Knife, he was hailed by governments for advancing the field of neurosurgery. And so the Gamma Knife, specifically designed to treat brain tumors, is one technique. And since it was proven to be effective there, people used engineering solutions to create treatments elsewhere in the body. And so we extrapolated the data from the brain to treat lung tumors, liver tumors, spine tumors, pancreatic tumors. And so again, one of the things that I also tell medical students and residents is what we do today is super, super advanced. And it's very different than how we did things 50 years, 60 years. And in the future, people will look back at what we're doing today and say, wow, we are much more advanced than what they did in 2024, right?
That's embarrassing.
So change is the nature of the game and what we do. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons that I really like being part of academia. We add to new knowledge. We figure out new ways to use these very specific technologies. One super exciting thing that I'm studying a lot about is the interaction with immunotherapy and radiation. And very briefly, my thoracic surgery friends and I kind of discussed this. What's better? If we have a single lung tumor, should we treat it with stereotactic radiation or should we remove it surgically? And my argument is if we treat it with radiation, another really interesting thing happens. The cells, as they go through the process of apoptosis, actually kind of lyse open up. The interior contents create antigens that are recognized by the immune system, and so that it can make the immune system kind of primed, and then immunotherapy after radiosurgery may be able to affect the development of metastatic disease. And that's actually been shown in some studies. And so that's really, really interesting. So along those lines, when I want to arm wrestle my thoracic surgery colleagues and say, hey, maybe radiation may win on this line.
Yeah.
But we'll see, right? So more data is needed to come out to, you know, figure out the interplay with radiation and immunotherapy. Super, super exciting. One more thing that I will say about that Another really interesting word that I talk to the medical students and residents about is the abscopal effect of radiation. And so when you treat something, you can treat a primary tumor. And then if there are other sites of disease, sometimes those sites of disease that were not treated actually start to show resolution on imaging. And so we used to think that was, you know, an anomaly. How did that occur? Now we have a great reason for that. If we're unleashing the immune system to the antigens of the primary tumor, the immune system may be able to be enhanced and actually go after other sites of disease. And so I'm super optimistic about the future just because we are seeing some results that we have not seen before with immunotherapy and the interplay where people with stage four disease and some situations such as melanoma or lung cancer, if they have the right series of mutations, even with stage four disease, we're seeing a long-term survivors. And that's been kind of a game changer recently.
Even outside of the argument of doing immune therapy after giving radiation, that phenomenon exists in and of itself, the abscopal effect, even without the immune therapy. You're basically uncovering a bunch of, you know, potentially wanted posters or features of this tumor for your immune system to say, oh, now I have a better idea of this culprit that was, you know, hidden really well in camouflage. And you say, oh, you know, blue eyes. I'm not saying that because you have beautiful blue eyes, brown eyes, whatever. And they're like, okay, now if I look at that more closely, then you may be able to kind of isolate or locate some of these camouflage tumors, because we know a part of a lot of pathogenesis of a cancer is actually disguising itself or hiding from the immune system itself, because our immune system does a really good job to protect us. So, you know, the thought in addition to that, to add not necessarily an immune booster, I don't know how I feel about that term, but something to help heighten the products of that abscopal effect is an interesting concept. We actually had Ian Walters talk about one of the technologies where it's kind of back to the basics is what he called it, but they would just inject tumors on purpose for a similar reason, whether it's, if it's not radiation, it's just to poison it directly rather than giving it IV through your vein and circulating, and then hoping this kind of gets unlocked to be able to help, quote unquote, present, right, to your immune system to go attack it. With all that said, or kind of in concert with that, is there valid literature support to have concerns? I get this question a lot on adding immunotherapy to what's called concurrent chemo radiation. So, and I'm sure you'll talk about this, but adding chemo, even a weekly chemo or 2-3 weeks, depending on the tumor type and setting, you know, it's not just an additive effect. It's not like, oh, you get 2 points for the chemo and you get 7 for the radiation. Now you have 9. It's more like 7 + 2 = 12. Like you get the synergistic effect. But people are starting to wonder, well, shoot, should we go ahead and do immunotherapy in addition to the chemo radiation that we're already doing for head and neck and for lung cancers? And then some people are, you know, have the thought, well, what if it causes, you know, a further increase in quote unquote pneumonitis, which is a side effect we fear with immune therapy where the immune cells start kind of attacking the lung tissue. Is that a valid concern, or is it more of a, hey, if you're going to get pneumonitis from immune therapy, you're going to get it kind of independent of what's happening to your lung tissue?
So I would say it's a totally valid concern. You know, we're still immunotherapy, you know, unleashes the immune system, and the immune system is oftentimes, you know, a component of all the inflammatory responses that we see, all the itises, you know, colitis, pneumonitis. You know, I've seen some unusual side effects like uveitis, you know, and so there are the spectrum of side effects are different than systemic chemotherapy. Okay. And we're just getting comfortable with that. And seeing how the immunotherapy interplays with concurrent chemo radiotherapy, because we're getting better and better with all sorts of treatments, you know, take stage 3 lung cancer, you know, the addition of immunotherapy has been a wonderful adjunct to concurrent chemo radiotherapy, which has been the standard of care. And so I think this is an active area of research where we're going to be going systemically through all the bodies, all the different tumor types, and seeing how they interact with immunotherapy and see what the toxicities are and what we have to be concerned about. You know, I think most medical oncologists that I'm working with are keeping a kind of a card with them as far as all the different possibilities for the immunotherapy side effects, because it's slightly different than the original training of, you know, you use these chemotherapies and you anticipate nausea, you know, at this time, you anticipate hair loss at this time. Now with immunotherapies, we're seeing sometimes delayed side effects, delayed inflammatory responses. And so even if somebody is presenting to a medical office 3 months after they received immunotherapy, it's still a possibility that that pneumonitis or that cough could be related somehow. So I think that that's going to be for the next period of time. And, you know, I'm going to speculate here. I would say in the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to be systematically going through all the disease sites and seeing the interplay between immunotherapy and chemo radiotherapy.
Yeah, it's so nuanced and enigmatic. Yeah. And I'm going to pin this for later in this discussion, but that's where I think, you know, things like AI are really just so important and key to making sense of it all. You know, simply one easy example is how allergic someone is to a bunch of foods or a bunch of things, you know, varies, we know and have known for a long time, on really both the thymus and the kind of development at younger years, but also what you're exposed to, your microbiome. We know all of that has a very obviously direct play on allergies, immune responses, heightened immune responses, to where I don't know that we'll ever be able to say, oh, this will always happen regardless of if you were the kid that was barefoot and climbing around trees and eating, you know, a heterogeneous diet, ethnic and American and everything else, versus somebody that had sanitizer and you know, chicken nuggets every day. We know that relationship exists. We know immune therapy is, you know, autoimmune-ish because your own cells are attacking something in your body. So again, I think it takes a level of computation and pattern recognition, which it's just hard to conceive one human mind being able to make those ties for things that seemingly seem very unrelated. But we'll get to that, I hope. I see you smirking and salivating at that.
Well, I do. I have a lot to say on this. I really think you touched on some really important topics there. I think there are like two paths that we're going to go down, you know, to paraphrase Led Zeppelin, right? So one of them is people will get a diagnosis and then we're figuring out the best way to treat that diagnosis. And with all the technologies that we have available, there's a spectrum of radiation technologies that we have. There are new chemotherapy agents, there are new immunotherapy agents, and we're going to have to do the best we can for everybody that comes down the pipe, right? And then comes down with one of these diagnoses. I think next level of healthcare is actually healthcare, not reactive care. And by that, I mean, let's prevent the cancer in the first place. And this is where the big data, the AI analytics, I think are going to have a huge impact on our lives, right? I really foresee this in the future where AI is going to be saying, all right, all these people that had this particular diagnosis, and maybe they'll collect the information and kind of do a backward analysis and say, well, you know, holy cow, they had this kind of commonality or this genomic predisposition or something like that. The cancer that we are diagnosing today did not start today. The heart disease that happened today, the heart attack that happened, did not start today. It started sometime in the past. And we can speculate right now, but I think our computational analyses of the data that actually exists is going to be such that we're going to have better predictive analytics. And we're going to have more suggestions on what to do for prevention. And I kind of laugh and talk to my wife about this. I say, yeah, we're going to get really smart. And it's going to come down to some of the basic things that we already say, like, hey, maybe drink more water, maybe eat a healthy diet, maybe get plenty of sleep and get some exercise, right? We may come back to some basics, but I think it's going to be enhanced basics with some data saying, oh, by the way, you're genomically have a predisposition for this particular situation. So maybe if you take this nutritional supplement, it reduces your likelihood of these bad things happening. And so by efforts like this, I think we'll be able to delay the onset of some of these scary diagnoses. cancer is, I would say right now, is kind of transitioning from acutely life-threatening. I totally recognize that it can be acutely life-threatening, but it's almost transitioning from, you know, that to a disease of chronic illness, right? Management of chronic disease. Oftentimes people that have diabetes live with that and manage that and have a normal life expectancy, right? And cancer may become that way. Some pathologists and I were speculating, you know, over dinner one time, just about how right now we go through this major effort. Somebody gets a diagnosis, then we do all these scans to find out where it is in their body, and then we stage it, and then we have guidelines. And so we treat according to the guidelines. So we're guideline concordant. Then we can anticipate, predict what their survival will be statistically. Now, statistics break down on an individual basis. That's current state, right? But in the future, we anticipate that you'll sample a tumor. You'll figure out what the genetic thing trigger is for that cell to continue to divide, and we'll develop targeted therapies for that tumor. So then it doesn't matter where it is, doesn't matter where it started. And that's, there are some FDA clearances for, you know, tissue agnostic treatments. And that's super exciting. The difficulty is the genetic makeup of us and the way we kind of develop over time is super sophisticated. I'm using the word super a little bit too much, but things change over time. The cells can mutate and they're trying to survive as we're trying to go after them. So if we sample somebody and sample some tumor and we're treating it, that treatment may be effective for a period of time, then it may not be effective because the tumor has mutated some way. And then we anticipate sampling it again, figuring out what the new mutation is, and then treating that. And so I think that's a paradigm that will happen in our careers. And I think it will go to the point where treatments are more effective and less toxic and more targeted, and people have a better life expectancy, and it won't be as ominous a diagnosis as it is right now. It'll be more like a nuisance diagnosis, like, oh man, I have to go see a medical oncologist. Oh man, I have to see a radiation oncologist, but it's not overwhelming.
I certainly
are overwhelming at that
right.
time.
Yeah. I mean, I pray that to be the case. I do everything in my power, my wife as well, to try to help bring that day sooner. Cause I regularly see the faces of, hear the voices, even of patients that, you know, it's impossible not to just really love, and anyone you care about, anybody. And I think we all have this inherent, you know, when you invest someone, it doesn't matter what they're like, if they're nice, if they're mean, whatever, when you invest, like, it just, part of you is invested, I think, emotionally, I think. And that's how I feel. And I, you know, I just almost want to, in service or in homage to some degree, help catalyze that. But to your point, I mean, I think the brain doesn't know, one does not know what to ask, like, if the brain doesn't know it. One doesn't know what they don't know. And so, you know, you have to, how can you even think to look at certain patterns or relationships on your own, like just out of the blue? And that's what we're, to this point, a lot of our observational stuff and our data doesn't really put into account what somebody's diet is like fully, right? Like with several of the standard guidelines, it doesn't put in what their immune system's like. And so how would you know to think, for example, Dr. Cindy Patel and William Lee both mentioned the PAIRS study that came out within the last year. And if you ate a certain number of PAIRS regularly in your diet, you seem to have a better response to immune therapy. Like, who would have ever thought, right, to actually think about something like that or to make that relationship? And then we look into it and we're like, oh, this kind of makes sense. So a lot of these things where we're just kind of like, we don't know why or how come it works in some and others, it doesn't. One, because we haven't factored in a lot of the, at that moment, not only what their genetic makeup is that they were born with, but really what's evolved in terms of their immune system, how it's matured. Who knows if having 5 courses of antibiotics during your treatment course versus 0 makes a difference on how bad your immune toxicity is. That's what AI, I think, you know, adjunctively can offer. It can at this just logarithmic level, at least just assess for relationships that can seem totally random. What if having peanuts all the time is bad for immune therapy versus good, and so forth? So I think that's, you know, I hope people listening can maybe appreciate why, one, it's been challenging thus far, but two, you know, the limitations of the computational bandwidth of a brain versus a computer on being able to answer these things sooner and then hopefully having much more tailored and refined expectation and outcome rather than a 40% chance to respond. I'm like, dude, that means there's a majority chance that I won't, and this is the best treatment we have. I mean, why that big variability, you know? And then some people have complete responses. So I think all of that is going to be something that we should kind of embrace just in humility, because we can at least say we don't have a lot of answers for a lot of things and those patterns we've tried to recognize to this point. Now, with all that said, I think one of the questions that I get often, you've already kind of answered, or we've answered, and that's, well, why don't, if radiation works so well and it kills things, why don't we just zap all the spots, right? And we talked about that micrometastatic disease, the stuff you can't see. So you're not able to really attack the things that you can't see based on, you know, modern imaging. Of course, we'll talk about kind of, you know, maybe metabolic ways to be able to see cancer cells in a way that's much better than pictures that we use today. We talked about that in our podcast with Senolisense and the whole tissue agnostic concept on a metabolic level, but that's a whole different conversation. But you can't zap the things you don't see, number one. And then number two, depending on the extent, especially if it's close to bones and stuff, or the reason we don't use radiation often with, you know, intestinal cancers is it just causes a lot of injury and distress in the surrounding tissue and can have serious side effects. So that's kind of two of several answers on why you can't just go zapping everything, unfortunately. I'm just going to throw this out there. Is there something, or are there things being looked at to where you can have a targeted radiation delivery based on maybe the unique metabolic properties of a cancer that you just kind of attach on some, you know, pardon my ignorance, photon or whatever, to be able to go and inject it? Is there things like that being looked into?
Well, yeah, there are. And that's an active area of research as well. We do that in the clinic today. You know, if you think about radium-223, Xofigo, that's something that we use for people that have metastatic prostate cancer with, you know, kind of bone alone metastatic disease or limited systemic disease. And so that's a targeted radiotherapy that we use that's literally injected into the body every, you know, once a month for 6 months in a row. That's one example. There are also things that attach to lymphocytes, et cetera.
And so, neuroendocrine, right? Neuroendocrine, luteinizing.
Yes. So that's an active area. And so the radiopharmaceuticals is a whole subsection of radiation oncology. And we'll talk about that. I just want to put a little bit of optimistic spin of what's happening out there. Yes, you know, for a lot of the diseases that we have, their response rates are less than 100%. And so, yeah, it's not affecting everybody. But when I'm talking to groups of medical oncologists, I show a graph from American Cancer Society, and it's over time from the 30s to now. And it's looking at lung cancer, stomach cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, et cetera. And the survival rates are just dramatically better. And so oftentimes I'm saying, well, whatever you're doing, keep doing it, because we're getting better and better and better. Yes, we have lots of room to improve, and we will continue to refine that, but we're treating much more effectively today. And one of the things that I'm really optimistic about as well is organizations like ASCO and ASTRO and ACCC and all that, as soon as something has been proven to be effective, we're promoting it at the speed of light. You know, and so that's why somebody develops some really great technology in Seattle, Washington. You know, oftentimes the next day we can use it in Virginia. You know, so the internet and the information kind of transmission is better than it's ever been. And another thing that I just want to, a big plug for oncologists in general, the patients nowadays can read everything I can, right? 50 years ago, we didn't have the internet. And so you kind of had to go to your medical professional to get the latest information, but that medical professional was somewhat limited, right? Because it couldn't know absolutely everything. But nowadays, when patients can read everything that I can read, some people question, well, what's the role for an oncologist? Well, being in the field for over 20 years, I may have a little bit different insight. And so I may be able to like help explain like, this is why we image as frequently as we do, or why we don't need all those special images because it doesn't show up in this particular situation. So I think oncologists can provide context, whereas people that are reading something for the first time, it may be a little bit daunting because it is kind of detailed information. So I think there's going to be a strong role for oncologists in the future. now and into the future. But as far as technologies and techniques, the radiopharmaceuticals is one targeted way of treating. One thing I've said many times is if I have cells in a petri dish, I could turn on a radiation beam on that petri dish full of cancer cells, leave the beam on all day and all night, get 100% cell kill, right? The problem is cancer cells in humans are not in a petri dish. They're surrounded by all sorts of critically normally functioning cells. And so we're trying to do it in such a way that's minimally toxic to the normal tissues. And so those are the discussions that we're having in our department every day with my colleagues. You know, we're talking about how do we do this most effectively, least risk to the normal tissues.
David, that is an excellent lead for one of the most common concerns and questions I get on social media. And that's really with friends and family as well. The question becomes, do I need to go to a center and travel somewhere for proton therapy? I want the best either for myself or my dad or my mother. What can you tell us as far as not the theory, but the objective evidence today on having possibly a more targeted or less quote unquote bleed or injury when it comes to proton therapy and more conventional therapy?
So I'm really on the fence about protons. I'm not a current proton user. And so I will say this from study. I've been through several university courses on protons, and I know the science behind it. And protons create kind of a conundrum in American healthcare. It's a great technology, and it does have certain segments of the population, for instance, pediatric cases are kind of ideally treated with protons in some circumstances. Photons, so the difference between a proton and a photon for those out there, a proton is a positively charged particle. It's a literal particle. A photon is a packet of energy, and they have different interaction in tissue. A proton, as it travels through tissue, has little entrance dose, and at a certain depth, it deposits its energy, and that's called the Bragg peak. But where it deposits its energy is kind of like a point. And tumors are not points. They have a depth and a thickness. And so to make sure the protons cover the entire tumor, you actually put something in front of the beam to effectively degrade it to spread out the Bragg peak. And so you look at these proton plans, they talk about the SOBP, spread out Bragg peak. And what that does is that when that thing in front of the proton beam creates a situation where you have more entrance dose than anticipated. And so sometimes people have some additional toxicity too. Toxicities are generally manageable, but there are some toxicities that it's being worked out, I should say, and there are several clinical trials that are looking at the utility of the proton therapy to see, is this the next level for radiation oncology? Don't really know the answer to that just yet. Now, I've spoken to several of my colleagues that work with protons, and I've seen people that are huge proponents of it. I've seen others that are less enamored with the technology. One radiation oncology colleague that I know at the Miami Cancer Institute, I love his take on it. He says, well, what we do at MCI is treat everybody with the best technology that we have available. You know, so it doesn't matter what machine they need. We'll look at their disease and we'll treat them. And we're kind of machine agnostic. We'll just use whatever is the right thing. And that's a powerful statement, but that's also a very well-resourced center that has basically every radiation technology available, and that may not be feasible everywhere in the U.S.
So the theory, I think you did a great job of explaining it, the theory behind the proton is, I almost see kind of the movies when you see this asteroid or comet coming in, you know, to the atmosphere, and you see it kind of like hot and buzzing, and then it's starting to kind of, you know, disappear, lose that blue-orange light that's coming in. You're trying to reduce the amount of quote-unquote bleed of the energy for it to get to its destination, and theoretically hoping that you're able to keep as much of it as possible to then at a precise time, quote-unquote, honestly detonate, but discharge that, you know, potentiated stuff in that proton at a specific distance
rather than losing maybe 20-30% of your quote unquote punch power or fuel power with traditional photon therapy. Is that correct?
So yeah, so the proton science, again, really interesting, but so as the proton literally goes into tissue, it loses energy, then it deposits all of its energy at a specific point, right? And so the models have a very precise point where it loses energy. There's a little uncertainty with that, okay? And if there's uncertainty with the range, then if you're worried about very careful, you know, normal anatomy that may be adjacent to the tumor, that's something that has to be taken into consideration. And so that's what they're working on. You know, protons are a great technology. It's not a perfect technology. I think it will always have a role in radiation. Will it have an increasing role? It might. I think there are certain things that, like the pediatric cases that are, it's ideally suited for, that will continue. But the investment right now is so large that it's hard to justify that for most centers. Sure. But I think in America, there are 44 centers that are active. And so that means 44 centers have actually made the investment and the significant investment. And that does tell, like, the communities that they are willing to invest that for, you know, a technology that they believe in.
So I have somewhat of a, I guess, a silly or very basic way of asking this question, but I really hate, quite frankly, to have to tell a patient that is a head and neck patient in the oropharynx or rectal anal patient about the curative therapies when it comes to chemo radiation, just because I cannot conceive how brutal it is, but I see it very closely, and it's clearly, you know, something that is a tough thing to incur. So anyone that knows anyone that has that, please empathize. It's hard to even watch participating in the care. But with that said, why are those, is there something about those areas, both ends, that make radiation just such an effective tool? And I guess you could broaden that question to talking about what just makes something quote unquote radio sensitive versus quote unquote radio resistant, kind of like sarcomas and some other things that was like, meh, it doesn't work as well. We know replication is one of those things. If it doesn't replicate that fast, it may not be as effective. We know immune system plays a part because pancreas is still, you know, heavily studied. You know, we know that it replicates fast, and why isn't it a home run? But that's because we know that they kind of evade the immune system. But what is it about those sensitive areas, if anything, on why radiation is just going to be hard to beat when it comes to concurrent treatments, or just what makes something resistant or sensitive?
Well, in the early days of radiation, a lot of work was done to look at cell sensitivity to different types of cells. And oftentimes when you're talking about both ends, the head and neck or the bottom, we're talking about squamous cell, right? And so squamous cells happen to be cells that are sensitive to radiation, but you still have to treat to an effective dose to eradicate cancer. Let's take a little step back, though. I want to look at the alternative to chemotherapy and radiation. And one of the reasons that radiation exists, it's an effective treatment, and you get to preserve organs, right? And so, not to be indelicate or anything, but there are alternatives to radiation, right? And one of the alternatives, if there are head and neck cancers, sometimes it's a total laryngectomy. Sometimes that's the absolute right thing for people to do. That relegates somebody to having an electrolarynx and maybe difficulty speaking, communicating, swallowing, etc. And so sometimes there's an alternative treatment, such as chemotherapy and radiation together, that allows you to preserve that function. Having said that, it's not easy, as you alluded to. It's one of the most toxic treatments that we have, and oftentimes people have dry mouth, and saliva has a lot of protective antibodies and that sort of thing. And so people that have dry mouth have dental issues, and that's why we're so critical about, or so adamant that people get appropriate dental care both during treatment and forevermore afterwards. But it does allow people to preserve their function, even though it may be imperfect, okay? Same sort of thing with anal canal cancer. One of the most effective treatments for anal canal cancer is resection, and that leaves somebody with a permanent colostomy. And so I think it was Dr. Nigro back in the day thought that maybe doing something using chemotherapy and radiation might be able to minimize the chance of it coming back. And then he had several, he allowed people to be treated with chemotherapy and radiation before surgery. And then he had several pathologically complete responses. And then, so the story of anal canal cancer is kind of interesting. So now chemotherapy and radiation has effectively become the standard of care, right? And even though chemotherapy and radiation to that part of the body, things may not function like they did, pre-diagnosis, pre-condition. And so, but even so, and again, this may be debatable, is their current function better or not better than having a colostomy? And I've seen debates on both ends.
Yeah, I love that answer. And I suspected that to be the case. It's preservation. It's the long-term, like, what is the alternative versus, yes, what's very difficult now, is it still a better quality of life afterward? Because we know the good tissues do recover, most of the time to solid degree. So that's...
Well, and I will say this, both the head and neck and the anal canal cancers can be sometimes HPV mediated.
Wow.
And that's kind of portending a favorable prognosis for those disease types. And so one active area of investigation is the possibility of de-escalation of therapy to have the similar favorable long-term outcomes with less toxicity.
Yes.
And so that kind of remains to be seen if we can effectively do that.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, even with rectal adenocarcinomas, I think it's gone a little back and forth, with the radiation.
Right.
Is it curative? And then watch, and then do you do the consolidated, boost or the 3 to 5 treatments versus the long course.
Right.
And then everything got shaken up when you had this quote unquote miracle drug, the dostarlimab, that I think was a little misleading in the media, because it's like, well, shoot, they've had this drug for a while and it just makes it go complete response. It did, but it had a feature that was only present, unfortunately, in 2 to 3% of colorectal cancers, which, yes, if you're listening to this and you have colorectal cancer, or quite frankly, any solid tumor, you must make sure your oncologist has checked, especially in a stage 4 setting, for MSI high, status or what's called MMR deficiency, because we know that 2 to 3% in colorectal, when you have that feature, you're exquisitely sensitive to immune therapy, right? And so that could hopefully be a buyout, which is better than the alternative surgery, and then potentially even better than the alternative of chemoradiation. So like we keep saying as a recurrent theme, we're discovering these things and hopefully making things more tolerable. And at the same time, the biggest trade-off is more effective. So very interesting. And I think a beautiful answer that hopefully makes sense to the most, to a lot of people. Now, I'm going to say this also a little embarrassingly, but, medical oncologists in general, we've had a few radiology rotations, right? Like in med school, or the 14 years of training to be triple sports boarded, you have in med school, a couple of residency, a couple of fellowship. I was always taught by my program director at Weisweiler Cancer Center, Dr. Manser, to open up every scan. So I've self-taught. But one thing that, is an embarrassing thing is I'll still defer to the radiology report and the radiologist reading at the time. And sometimes there's this false scares of radiation necrosis, which is like, even on a PET scan, it's avid, because avid meaning, there's uptake or brightness because there's activity and that lesion, maybe you did SBRT or stereotactic radiotherapy that you mentioned earlier, focused onto one spot. 6 months later, it shows, activity on a PET scan, especially in the brain, to where we're still, and pardon me if this is not the right way, but I know, in the South, we still sometimes have to do a craniotomy or take out that lesion area in the brain to see if it's indeed necrosis or active tumor, that it could be that elusive on scans. So can you tell us and maybe this is an ignorant question, but what makes it so difficult? And are there any kind of imaging modalities or new things on the horizon that can help us hopefully, avoid false scares or differentiate the two without sticking a needle in it?
Well, you bring up a great point and a concern that we all have. So whenever we treat somebody, we follow them often both clinically and radiographically. And sometimes we find something radiographically that we are uncertain to what it is. And there are different modalities. You mentioned the PET scan, the MRI scans, looking at edema around it. And then every now and then, we still do exactly what you talk about. Sometimes there's some question whether or not this is active tumor, specifically talking about brain tumors, or is it radiation necrosis? And radiation necrosis is kind of a diagnosis of exclusion. And sometimes we're uncertain. If it doesn't respond to steroids, and I've seen situations where people have had craniotomies after radiosurgery, and it was exactly that. It was radionecrosis. I've also seen people have similar imaging characteristics, and they had craniotomy after radiosurgery, and there was active tumor. And so you bring up a point that's really kind of critical in all of healthcare. It's a multidisciplinary approach. And so I love that in healthcare. It's definitely, it's a team sport. You know, anytime that I am concerned about something, I bring it to my neurosurgery colleagues, I bring it to my radiology colleagues, my medical oncology colleagues, and then we put our minds together and we figure out, is there another imaging modality that we should do? And sometimes we do other imaging, and still there can sometimes be uncertainty. And if there is uncertainty and it's the right thing to do, they oftentimes will have an operation. I'll give one little example, and this is a little less common nowadays, but we were doing a lot of accelerated partial breast irradiation with a mammocyte technique. So that's a situation where somebody has a breast cancer, it's been removed, and instead of doing multiple weeks of radiation, they would have a catheter placed, and then you treat twice a day for 5 days, right? And so it was attractive to a lot of people. Well, one thing that can happen afterwards, and so many people across America have had this treatment, is later on, you know, months to a year later or something, there can be a fibrotic reaction called fat necrosis that feels like a lump. And so if you talk to a woman that's been through breast cancer and say, oh, there's a lump there, that kind of sends them kind of makes them very alert, and they're very concerned about this. And I had one woman who developed a lump in the area where this original surgery was done, and she had imaging, and the imaging was equivocal. And the surgeon said, oh, that's likely what's called fat necrosis. It's probably nothing. And so, but she couldn't sleep at night. And so she ended up having a biopsy. And as you know, the biopsy was right into the middle of it, and they pulled it out and looked at it under the microscope, and it was fat necrosis. And then the pathologist also says underneath it, well, this doesn't sample the whole tumor, so I can't exclude that there's some viable cancer elsewhere. And so the woman, again, had a negative biopsy. She couldn't sleep at night because it could be somewhere else. She ended up having a re-excision of that whole area. They looked at it under the microscope, all fat necrosis. And so, and then she could sleep at night, right? And so the radiation can cause some things that are difficult to interpret over time. And so then you use best clinical judgment, get multiple minds involved, and kind of move forward that way. But again, this kind of speaks to the different side effect profiles that are possible with focused radiation or short courses of radiation that we're very kind of aware of.
No, that brings a great point. On why things can be equivocal. And hopefully anyone, you know, hearing this, maybe, again, I try to really identify the places of potential and reasonable mistrust when it comes to, you know, your treating facility or physician, that they're hearing that this can be, you know, rather lucid at times. I'm hoping, you know, personally, that molecular testing, as we get more and more sensitive, not just molecular, but in the sense of circulating tumor DNA from the tumor, so where you can look at the tumor, see what, you know, the blueprint look like and try to quote unquote catch it. One, technology will get more sensitive at needing less and less to be able to identify it. But two, you'd have to think in a perfect world, you know, we just sample it once, but what if it matters more in the morning or nighttime? What if I just sampled three different times in the day for a week, you know, that it would be more sensitive, that hopefully that could help to say, whoa, we're a year out. Why do you have this circulating tumor DNA that, you know, similar to your matching tumor? There's also some talk about, and again, the Sonola Sense podcast we did on identifying what cancer types or how they're unique with their metabolism or appetite to be able to grow as a cancer. So they look at alanine, basically consumption, or you could, you know, isolate a different amino acid, and then you kind of put a radio tracer or some kind of way to image and appreciate that, so that you would see a different light up on that radiation necrosis, you know, breast mass or lung mass, and you would see the constellation of it and say, oh, this kind of looks more like, you know, white blood cells and inflammatory stuff, or this looks like active tumor. Granted, metabolically, they're sometimes similar too, which is why going pure keto can sometimes slow down your white blood cells. So anyway, lots to be able to hopefully uncover in that capacity.
Well, if I can add something, you bring up a really great point just about how, you know, in different points of the circadian rhythm daily, you know, our hormonal milieu is different. And so that may create different expression in our genome, right? And so anytime we get one series of images or one genetic profile, that's one snapshot point in time. And one thing that we all know is the body is dynamic. It changes over time, may change for the better, may change for the worse, you know? And so I think we're going to get smarter as to, you know, timing of treatments. Work has been done about, you know, do treatments, are they better in the morning or the afternoon or in the evening and that sort of thing. And so we're starting to look at that. This is where I really think AI is going to come into play, because we're going to, I have hopes that we get there, and I think we will. I don't know how soon, that we're going to get insights from analysis of large data sets that are not going to be intuitively obvious. And so when you're talking about the peaches or that sort of thing, you know, that's where I think AI is going to really hit its stride, is because we're going to realize something that may seem obvious after the fact, you know, but not just intuitively obvious right now. And so maybe things that you did as a child, now we can't change that, and so we can just be, you know, do the best we can from this point forward and be the healthiest version of ourselves. But I think we're going to get a little bit better at predictive analytics based on genomic profile and environmental factors and all of that. So I'm really optimistic about the future, and I really think that we're going to go down a pathway. We're going to go down two pathways. One is the actual treatment pathway, doing the best thing. The other pathway, which I'm also super excited about, is the whole prevention pathway.
Yes.
And I think that's where special sauce is.
100%. I mean, pattern recognition. I mean, that's one of the biggest, you know, the attractive things about AI is just recognize patterns. Just tell us, I mean, just tell us that there's this relationship that, again, somebody may not be asking the question or having to check, you know, or conduct a study, but when you have that stuff, and that's the whole purpose of data. So when people say share your data, is there more data sharing? You know, people may not know this, but there is a lot of not sharing when it comes to data and healthcare and marketing. And I don't mean by people,
right.
I mean by institutions. Like, you know, it's everywhere because, well, for whatever reason, pick your reason. But the point is, that is the concept. Anyone listening, is behind that. So imagine in an ideal world, de-identified. So they don't know who you are. They don't care about, you know, the taxes and the and your social security number. But just knowing what time you got your treatments. Cortisol is higher. You know, you get a little spike in the morning. So does that matter? Because we know cortisol downregulates your immune system versus, you know, later in the day. Mm-hmm. Like all of these things that happen, we can start making relationships and seeing, well, for whatever reason, the people they got in AM had this versus PM versus that, versus somebody ate a lot of peanuts, so they had more immune sensitivity. I know I said that twice. I'm just making that up. I don't know if there's data on that, so please don't think I'm suggesting something. But my point is, we have to like recognize patterns, then be able to ask questions to say, why do these patterns exist? And I think that will really help catalyze and facilitate discovery you know, in a much faster sense. I have to ask, with your experience, you know, being, you know, on aircrafts and having been a Navy surgeon, do you feel any kind of philosophical relation, especially with you being a thought leader on the cutting edge of AI and technology and innovation as it relates to, you know, what I, in a biased manner, think is one of the most complicated you know, anomalies or pathogens of the humankind, which is cancer. How does that interplay for you? Is there a full circle that you're seeing in your career thus far? Or,
well, my undergraduate degree was electrical engineering, and I thought at one time I'd be a surgeon, right? And kind of along the pathway of neurosurgery. And then when I was in the U.S. Navy, once you have your medical license, I did a surgical internship. Once you have your medical license, they want to get some work out of you. And so then that's when I became a flight surgeon, and I loved it, right? And I also had the unfortunate experience of my mother being diagnosed with breast cancer and ultimately dying from that. And so, but when I visited her, this is where I learned about radiation oncology. I met this radiation oncologist that was treating her, and he was using all these sophisticated technologies. And I was like, holy cow, this is like applied engineering in the field of medicine. And so that's when I started studying it a little bit more through kind of a sad event in my life. I found kind of a pathway forward, and I'm very happy about it. And I do think it's applied engineering in medicine. And I think the sky's the limit. I think we're still figuring out ways to use this. I also want to just say that I participated in the CancerX Moonshot during their webinar, and they had, it was lots of different organizations such as ASTRO, ASCO, NCCN, ACCC, and others. All had kind of presentations, and when they gave their presentations, they have some pretty ingenious and sophisticated solutions for different aspects of what they were looking at. One of the comments made by the hosts was about data interoperability. They were like, "Wow, you guys all have great solutions, but I don't see any interconnectedness between your databases and these others." And here's a suggestion for a podcast, right? David Jaffrey, a PhD physicist, was hired from Princess Margaret Hospital to MD Anderson to lead their data analytics. Basically, and I'm going to paraphrase, and he's probably going to criticize everything I'm saying about this, but to look at their data and make their data usable in such a way that AI systems, et cetera, can develop solutions and get insights that may not be intuitively obvious. So David Jaffrey.
Absolutely.
So he may be somebody that's of interest to your audience.
And Corey Painter, that's an episode kind of talking about a similar thing. She, I think, was an artist, basically, right brain person by trade, got diagnosed with, I believe, synovial sarcoma. There's no data out there to really guide her. It's actually one of the things I'm going through with one of my close friends with a mesothelioma diagnosis. And it becomes a real issue to learn that people get it, and there's not a sharing of this information to guide the people that are inevitably going to get it in the future. And you know, that data point is I think so valuable, and I hope people, I'm sure, can appreciate that kind of hearing this and episodes like that. So, gosh, this has been, it feels like it's been 10 minutes, and it's already been, my goodness, an hour and 10 minutes. Is there anything else that you would love to kind of basically introduce to our palates or you know, our appetites on what technology kind of has in store that we already haven't talked about when it comes to radiation or cancer in general?
So, well, I'll just say this. I was in private practice for many years before going back into academia, and the private practitioners out there come from all the training programs that are named programs. And with the information transmission at the speed of light, I just want the audience to know that people in the community do great work, you know, and so you can get fabulous care in your backyard as a result of the transmission of information. And so I'm at an academic medical center, and when people come to see me, I say some of the same words that I said when I was in private practice, and somehow it carries a little bit more gravitas. And I totally understand that. We're an NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center, and that means that there's lots of oversight to our organization. But accredited organizations throughout the nation are doing fabulous work. And so I'm very optimistic about the future. I think we're getting more specific and better with our current treatments, and we will continue to have successes. And I think we may be on the verge of stepwise leaps in advancement of health, not just reactive healthcare, but maintaining health. And so I want every member of the audience to just be the healthiest version of yourself, you know, and stay tuned, because good things are coming down the road.
I love it. Thank you so much for that. Dr. David Penberthy, you've been riveting, and I'm sure we'll be bringing you back because there's just going to be too many updates to have to catch up on, hopefully at the continued speed we have today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Take care.